Hey folks, I'm Dave.
And I'm Rue.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Today we will be continuing our read of 1984 by George Orwell with, I believe, chapter 16.
Whoa.
Cue the music. So, you know, last week, I think, I mentioned that it was technically the end of summer. So we would probably stop complaining about how hot it was.
Yeah, and then we got hit by a heat wave. We're not happy. It's humid, although today is slightly less humid, but it's hot.
It's hot March.
Yeah.
Hot March.
It's very hot. It's stupid. Sorry, but yes.
Yeah.
So we're doing a thing. What am I doing? So yes, there is this thing. Social media has been an interesting place over the last few days.
Do tell.
Well, I've mentioned this today, or before we were recording. I've been following this story that was broadcast under the guise of a health journalism presentation about what's being done in one of the clinics in the US to treat pain, or a particular pain disorder that's seen in children and youth. I have opinions on it, and they're not particularly... I don't think it's a particularly good approach what they're going for. It's unethical and a whole bunch of other things. But the fun fact was that someone brought up George Orwell.
Oh.
They went, "What is this Orwellian nonsense?" Because essentially what they've been doing is they're training kids through adding physical pain to not complain about their existing physical pain. It is a bit more complicated than that. They have a hunch that's driving all this. No actual solid physiological data to support this approach. But basically kids get... The more a child complains about the pain or comments or discusses the pain, the more they're going to get a response of, okay, now go and give me 3 solid hours of running on the treadmill as a response to a child that is in pain. By the way, they have missed a lot of existing conditions in a lot of their patients, and it's really bad. But no, the treatment is just don't, if you're in pain and you complain about it, we're going to make you do... extreme physiological strenuous exercise till you are in agony, so that when you tell us afterwards, are you in pain, you're probably going to lie about it. But that's not what they intend. They just think the pain's going to reduce. That's the clinic is going by the premise of, they don't complain about their pain levels drop afterwards because they don't complain about it as much anymore. I wouldn't either if I was going to get tortured in the response of addressing my doctor with a question or pain or whatever.
This sounds like it doesn't pass ethics standards.
I don't know if it's gone past an ethics board. In fact, that's probably why the articles that have come out from it are a bit statistically dubious, to say the least. I don't know. If you scroll back in my timeline in my Twitter timeline, you're going to see a big chunk of info on it because I got grumpy.
Well, it's funny, whenever people say Orwellian as a descriptor, I always assume they're talking about 1984, but there is a chance they could be talking about Animal Farm as well.
In this particular case, they're going, what? I love the kind of little references I constantly see on Twitter or in other media forums. At least Ingsoc had the decency of restricting the 2 minutes hate to 2 minutes, for example, in response to someone a whole bunch of aggressive and hatred filled propaganda.
Actually, because of social media, you can be stuck in a 2 minutes hate for weeks.
Yep. And particularly if you watch one media collection organization, you're definitely going to cop it from all corners. I am not going to mention who I mean, because I'm suspecting everyone already knows.
Yeah, no, that's that is the weird thing, because it's almost like the the party kind of knew, you know, if we, well, also this was written long before anyone had any idea about social media.
Yeah.
But that idea that, no, we just need a quick valve release and re-energize. Because remember, we talked before about how the two-man take kind of has a dual purpose. It's to let out energy, but it's also to ramp it up.
It's a channel. Yeah, it's to direct the kind of energy that is permittable, if that makes sense.
But it's also to keep that tension there.
Yeah, because if they're not tense, if they're not constantly in fear or in anger, then they can't be manipulated, because those are very easy to manipulate emotions.
But it's only 2 minutes. It's 2 minutes every day. And, you know, if you aren't seen to be sufficiently angry, you will be investigated. That's why Julia always makes sure she is the most enraged. Like, I think Winston mentioned in one of the previous chapters that she threw a chair at Goldstein in the 2 minutes hate.
Yeah, she's done some. Although, if we go back to the book, that's possibly not wise. You don't want to be too passionate in a society where passion is being discouraged and channeled. And does that make sense? Yeah, I'm a little worried. Like that might have even been something that made her stand out too much. You don't want to stand out. The Japanese saying, the nail that sticks out gets hammered down.
Or as we Australians mention it, tall poppy syndrome.
Yep, if you're a tall poppy, you'll probably get your head lopped off. Things like that. I mean, not, by the way, we do not endorse these attitudes. We're just saying that that's...
They exist.
They exist, and they probably shouldn't exist but they do exist, especially in the Ingsoc world.
Well, and the way I've always seen, like, it is unhealthy the way it works in Australia, but I don't think it's meant to be. You know, the general idea, I think, is to dissuade arrogance.
Yes.
You know, don't be boastful, don't flaunt your accomplishments or how talented you are at something, because that will seem off-putting to those who aren't as talented or don't have your gifts. But it comes off being, no, if you are talented, don't show it, because you need to be made to feel bad about being better at something than someone else.
Yeah, it's become a very weird and unhealthy pattern. Humility is great. Humility is a fantastic quality. Humiliation, no, but humility in terms of if someone recognizes that there will always be, even if it's, there'll be at some stage someone who's better at something else or the same thing that you are. You might be really good at something, but someone else can also be really good at it, and they can even be better at it than you. That's not going to take away the accomplishment, and the abilities of others do not take away from your accomplishment and abilities.
Which is something that I have to remind myself daily.
All of us do. It's a universally challenging concept. It's the way that you know the expression comparison is the thief of joy. It could be the thief, or it could be a thief, but it is definitely.
You want to be competing with yourself as long as you feel that what you did today is better than what you did yesterday. And even that can be unhealthy because, well,
you can have a bad day.
Yes.
It's okay.
Yes.
It happens. Seriously. Do people think that everyone goes through life not having periods of time where they are struggling? Like, everyone is going to be struggling. The amount that they struggle may differ. The impact of that struggle may differ if you have things like material stability and things that mean that they're not adding pressure. The pressure is, I think, that's the thing. Everyone does struggle, but the pressure will differ. And that's the key difference. But then some people will really flourish.
Yeah. The amount of I remember hearing about people at uni who, you know, the stress of the deadline made them create their best work. Mm. Whereas for me, I mean, yes, I was one of those, oh God, I've not done anything and it's due tomorrow, so let me stay up all night to finish this. But that was I never felt like I did that because the stress of the deadline. I felt I did that because I've always had very poor time and energy management.
But it's also procrastination can be like to avoidance and procrastination. I have to look it up, but they're signs of trying to cope with anxiety that's induced by things, which can be a thing.
There's always a cause. And I feel if I go into it, we're probably... So the last couple of episodes, we probably talked a little too much at the start of the episode. So I'd like to maybe move on. Although last episode was very weird because, you know, we talked for about a half an hour at the start and then we covered two chapters because they were short chapters.
Yes, well, we cheated. We had short chapters. But yeah, it's an interesting, it's interesting when you look at how... Going back to the book, how in 1984 you're seeing this society where essentially I don't even know if comparison would thief them of anything. So say we have comparison is a thief of joy in this world, in this quote-unquote normal society, in the average society that we live in. Yeah, because when you start comparing yourself to others, you feel, that person has more, that person does more.
I don't think so, because this is obviously a critique of the growing stories about, communism in the USSR at the time, and that kind of totalitarian communist society.
Well, this is not... technically communism.
No, it's not at all. Even what it's called INSOC, English Socialism.
Yeah, it's socialism, but the same way that you had the National Socialistic Party of the Germans.
Oh, yes, it is a perversion
of... They say they're for the people.
Yes.
And yet...
It is a perversion of the name.
Well, the concept of social and social socialization and all these things.
But in a way, we're talking about comparison... is that, yes, we've talked many times about being the cog in the machine and everyone's got their specific duty to the party. And I think that's maybe why that doesn't exist in this society.
That's part of it. But also they're outright told your personal happiness is irrelevant.
Well, there is no happiness.
Well, that's what I mean. The happiness, joy, the only contentment that exists is to serve Big Brother.
Mm.
And to do your job, so to speak.
And to hate.
And to hate those that you're told to hate. So if you're in a constant state of fear and hate, you're manipulated and you're just basically told, this is it. And yeah, you put on blinkers. They've got these blinkers on, and the only way they're allowed to look is straight ahead at the telescreen. Do this.
And it's actually bring up, I saw a great YouTube video about this the other day about how rather than the news, which is supposed to be informing the populace, instead of talking about policy, all the coverage of this one thing has been... basically, whether or not it's good politics and what it means for the political parties, the policy itself and whether or not it's a good idea is never broached. And what happens is they say, because they've done studies on this, when you focus on tactics instead of the substance, basically what it does is engages the public's cynicism. So much so that even when after this idea has gone, the next idea that comes along, the public will be more cynical about it. And basically, when you engage people's cynicism and when you don't discuss policy and instead discuss tactics, you're making an ill-informed populace.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's amazing because that's just cynicism, not encouraging hate and anger like we're seeing here.
Well, it's cynicism... you could argue that cynicism is a manifestation of fear and hatred in a way. Not all of it, but in part, it shows it because it is a form of disgust that's kind of...
Right, it's that, what's the point? A hopelessness, in fact.
Yeah, so apathy is a really bad one, so obviously. So you end up, it's almost apathy to the point of an active, which was... strangely counterintuitive to the word apathy, but it's an active form of apathy.
How do you feel about apathy?
Like, what's the point? No, like that, and I think that the more we depend on the smoke and mirrors that are being the more we focus on the smoke and mirrors that are being used by political parties. Let's put it this way, without getting into the political parties
and the media.
And media and political parties.
Because let's be honest, sadly, at this point, at this point in history with Australia and America, both media and the politicians are basically bought by very rich people who are interested in their own concerns rather than the concerns of the public at large.
They need the population to be a certain way in order to profit from it. Yeah. It's as simple as that, to be blunt. But the thing is, the more we focus on the smoke and mirrors, the more we focus on personality, if that makes sense, that's what it is.
Yes, it is.
The less we're actually focusing on, okay, well, you know what? What can be done constructively? What can we do constructively? If, I'm not going to go into that one, but sorry.
Let us move to the book now, because 5 minutes ago we said we were going to move to the book.
So this book, in the book, we're about to see, he thinks, because that's how he's decided to interpret it. I mean, we know this book is not going to end well.
Really? What gives that away, Rue?
The dystopian element of it. Dystopias never end well.
What, you don't think Winston's going to spark the revolution? And
No. But it's actually interesting because this book ends up serving as a contrast to what we are capable of in this world. Yes, there's the parallels in terms of the smoke and mirrors and the media, huge. But in terms of the general population, and now we're going to have people who argue that, oh no, general population votes for smoke and mirrors. Of course they're going to vote for smoke and mirrors. There's no other option made accessible to them.
And as we've talked before, actually doing your own due diligence with researching things most people don't have the time and energy to.
The skills. They have not been trained because our education, back to the beginning of our podcast, education is key for that. And education and the access to education are manipulated by, guess who? The people who are in charge of the smoke and mirrors. Woo. So full circle. So what you can do, however, is accessibility to educational forums that are not necessarily... it's not necessarily university. It's not necessarily school or a high school or a diploma or whatever. People can very easily... So Dave, before the podcast, was mentioning that as we're going through 1984, because we're going through it chapter by chapter and breaking it down and actually kind of exploring the chapter as two people in this particular case. But you could do this with any material. You could sit down as a group. I mean, in some social settings and in some groups, they'll sit down and they'll study the Bible. I'm sorry if this is offensive to anyone who does not believe in the Bible, but if they're sitting down and they're studying, and they used to, in theory, sit down, and in some solid theological circles, it wasn't a case of someone going, hey, this is what it says and this is what it means. But you would actually encourage dialogue and what would this look like? How could we apply this? So if we're love thy neighbor as thou loves thyself, who does this include? This includes everyone, blah, blah, blah. So they'd actually have small groups, but they would actually discuss it and they'd apply it.
Criticism started that way. Yeah. It was wealthy people in, I believe, it was either France or England, but they would have parties where they went around and they held meetings to discuss the latest play or opera or the book they've read in a group. And then eventually they had people record the minutes of those meetings, and then suddenly they had little, zines with the press that they could, people who weren't able to attend were able to read up on what their peers thought of, the latest thing, and suddenly that flourished. In a way, criticism has always been at its best when it's a discussion between two or more people.
When there's dialogue, when there's collaboration, dialogue. I think what's happened is there's just this criticism for the sake of criticism is empty.
Well, at its core, or at least my beliefs as someone who's trying, who would love to make his living as a critic, I think the idea of critiquing art is you want to get at the heart of what this is trying to say, or what you think it's trying to say, or what it tells you about what it means to be human, or what it says to you. But basically, it's a bit of being a decoder, a bit of being a translator, but that's not really what
it is. The function, I'm going to make a general sweeping statement here. If we look at the function of criticism and dialogue as the purpose of gleaning insight and understanding, it changes the whole game. Because if it's not just, oh, I have an opinion and I'm going to share it because it's my opinion and I have a right to my opinion, who cares about an individual's opinion? Blunt. But if you go together and you listen to different kinds of opinions and you kind of go, oh, this is how they saw it. I didn't see that angle
especially
before.
If you talk to people face to face, because it's a lot easier to be able to have a dialogue with someone you may not agree with if you're in the same room.
Yeah, it's there's this social, if you foster these social connections, and social connections that encourage thought, but not just thought, application. So it's not just this is how we understood it now. Okay, well, what would that look like in society? That's why when we're going through 1984, we've been kind of reflecting on it, going, hey, are we seeing real world examples of this? Yeah, we are.
The answer is always yes, pertaining to this book.
Unfortunately, yes. But what can we do? What can we do that counters some of these patterns?
To interject, that will probably be a theme no matter what book we read, because you know, books are works of art, and any art that is worthwhile or keeps being relevant is because it has something to say on the human condition.
Yeah.
And, you know, we may gain technology, we may have different cultures, but I think for the most part, humans haven't changed that much over the centuries. And so we're going to see a lot of ourselves in these books.
The inherent nature of humanity, whether someone is optimistic regarding the inherent nature or someone is pessimistic, whatever, it's going to differ. But there are inherent qualities that you can see repeatedly throughout all our human civilizations and societies. Mm-hmm. And of course, art is always going to reflect on those core themes because, well, at least art that is lasting.
And I mean, the thing that you always have to remember is art is always of its time, and we do... It's a culture. I think that's mainly a culture thing. Our culture has changed. So certain things that were just accepted when something might be made, nowadays we look and then we go, ooh, I can't believe we used to act like that. But I think
someone's going to do the same to our generation.
Oh,
going,
oh no, I, no. Our, this period of history, oof.
Yeah.
They're not going to look back kindly on us.
Well, I don't know. I think they're going to see that there were some things, like you've got certain positive development. In fact, if we sat down and we really say, you set aside a week and you collected what are the positive accomplishments and movements going on right now, what's going on positive, hate the word positive versus negative. Is that maybe the word would be constructive?
But
is constructive and forward thinking?
Here's the thing though, even the constructive stuff, how we have no idea what's going to survive history.
Oh, no.
That was one thing that helped me break wanting to watch or listen to the news was, I forget if it was an article or if it was like a YouTube or a podcast thing, but it might have been a TED Talk. It was about how if you look at the stories being told, how many of them will matter in 1 year? 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, how little of the day-to-day actually important.
Some information is important to be versed on in terms of to know what is having an impact. But the same way, our news, for example, is very locally geared.
Mm.
But if you zoom back...
That local stuff is also, there was a car accident on this road.
Yeah, but that's today. The thing. Like, you kind of go, okay, well, that road's probably... And they say, oh, well, we're going to have to close off this bridge because it's going to be reconstructed, blah, blah, blah. The point is that it's so locally geared that you don't actually get a sense of... necessarily get a sense of human accomplishments. We also, news, the media is designed to be inherently focusing on problems and doesn't actually go into the... very rarely goes into positive accomplishments.
And it just occurred to me then, but I think the cynical part of it is, you know, how most of the news makes you sad or angry, and I think that's probably by design, because when you're sad and angry, you see things aren't right with the world, and then there's a bunch of advertisements that say, oh, if you want to feel better about yourself, buy this thing.
Yeah. It's we live in a society where
we are now 25 minutes into the episode.
But it's going to this thing of we make poor decisions. We have poor decision-making skill when we are constantly in an environment of fear and anger. And I believe this chapter will continue on poor decision-making.
Well, because the previous chapter, O'Brien kind of winked, well, it more than a wink, but basically invited Winston to his house and said, and in Winston's mind, this means, oh, O'Brien has a door to the resistance, and he knows I'm interested, and I'll be able to kickstart the revolution by by seeing my friend who I've always known and I've always trusted.
Yeah,
he's... And Rue was kind of going, oh, you poor sweet summer child.
Yeah, like going, this is one classic case of projection. Massive projection.
And this is off the back of Julian Winston becoming way too comfortable in Mr. Charrington's room.
Yeah, this is just not...
So we can maybe see that things are not moving in a positive direction.
Well, they're on the surface, they are positive, but if you actually go... in the context of this society, these are not good things. These are bad things.
And as I've said before, it may be now they're just at the point with, look, let's just live how we want so the end will come quicker.
Yeah, they've gotten to the point where we're going to die anyway, so we might as well just hope. That's the problem. They have, one of them at least, has hope. And it's not necessarily hope that they're going to survive. It's hope that they're going to make a difference.
Yeah, Winston really... And it's funny how Julia... says, you know, no, I don't think you're right, dear. We just need to get away with as much as we can. That's the only thing we can do.
Yeah, so they're really the not extremes.
It's the optimist and pessimist.
Well, no, they're the reflection of the only other feelings you can really develop in a society where you're constantly surrounded by fear and hate.
Yeah.
And if you're not a pearl.
The pearls have their own darkness to deal with.
Yes, they have. They're distracted enough. Thank you very much.
So, shall we continue?
Yes, please.
Okay. They had done it. They had done it at last. The room they were standing in was long-shaped and softly lit. The telescreen was dimmed to a low murmur. The richness of the dark blue carpet gave one the impression of treading on velvet. At the far end of the room, O'Brien was sitting at a table under a green-shaded lamp with a mass of papers on either side of him. He had not bothered to look up when the servant showed Julia and Winston in. Oh, yes. So it looks like Winston has brought Julia to O'Brien's.
Well, that seems like a good idea in a place when they're not meant to have a relationship or connection. That's so bright. That's really intelligent, Winston.
Winston's heart was thumping so hard that he doubted whether he would be able to speak. They had done it. They had done it at last, was all he could think. It had been a rash act to come here at all, and sheer folly to arrive together.
Okay, at least he has some self-awareness.
Though it was true that they had come by different routes and only met on O'Brien's doorstep. But merely to walk into such a place needed an effort of the nerve. It was only on very rare occasions that one saw inside the dwelling places of the inner party, or even penetrated into the quarter of the town where they lived. The whole atmosphere of the huge block of flats, the richness and spaciousness of everything, the unfamiliar smells of good food and good tobacco, the silent and incredibly rapid lifts sliding up and down, the white-jacketed servants hurrying to and fro, everything was intimidating. Although he had had a good pretext for coming here, He was haunted at every step by the fear that a black uniformed guard would suddenly appear from around the corner, demand his papers, and order him to get out. O'Brien's servant, however, had admitted the two of them without demur. He was a small, dark-haired man in a white jacket, with a diamond-shaped, completely expressionless face, which might have been that of a Chinese. Yes?
So I'm just listening to the reading, just this description of where they're living compared to where...
It's a different part of town, for one.
Yeah, firstly, yeah, different part of town, so they're probably never getting shellings. Unlike the proles. And then you've got the average party member.
They have maintained lifts that zip up and down.
Yeah.
He's smelling tobacco. Telescreen is a murmur, so it possibly has volume control.
Yeah, as opposed to the others. And dimmed. Mm. Yeah. This whole thing is just... the few exploiting the many for their own benefit. Yeah.
This is how the other half
lives. Here's the evidence. Well, not half.
Well, we don't know how
15% of the population is party members. Of that, only a select few are inner party members.
Right.
So we're talking about, you'd be talking about 1%.
The 1%?
The 1% of the population that are actually benefiting from everyone else's exploitation. Lovely.
The passage down which she led them was softly carpeted, with cream-papered walls and white wainscoting. All exquisitely clean. That, too, was intimidating. Winston could not remember ever to have seen a passageway whose walls were not grimy from the contact of human bodies. O'Brien had a slip of paper between his fingers and seemed to be studying it intently. His heavy face, bent down so that one could see the line of the nose, looked both formidable and intelligent. For perhaps 20 seconds he sat without stirring. Then he pulled the speakwrite towards him and rapped out a message in the hybrid jargon of the ministries. Items 1, 5, 7 approved full eye stop suggestion contained item 6 double plus ridiculous verging crime thing cancel stop unproceed construction wise anti getting plus full estimates machinery overheads stop end message.
Wait, what?
Want to try and decipher that?
So item 1, 5, 7. Okay, that's fine. Approved. Completely. Stop suggestion contained in item 6. It's extremely ridiculous, verging on
crime thing. So yeah, cancel it. Thinking,
cancel it. Stop. Okay, that's the next thing.
Do not proceed with...
Unproceed construction-wise.
Construction-wise anti-getting.
Anti when you up the ante... I'm thinking. So I think it's...
Because it's A-N-T-E instead of A-N-T-I.
Well, yeah. I'm getting that as anti... Sorry, anti. A-N-T-E, as Dave said. Yeah, I think it's profits... Profit. Estimates. Yeah, this is talking about, profit margins.
Right.
Because the machinery and the overheads are too expensive, basically. That's what... Yeah.
And the items on the memo, one of them was ridiculous, the others were completed.
Yeah, so 1, 5, and 7 are fine. Number 6 is ridiculous, verging on crime thought, so no. And then whatever the other, it wasn't an item number, but it's saying something about don't bother, don't focus on producing more produce or more profit building from that because the overhead machinery costs us too much.
He rose deliberately from his chair and came towards them across the soundless carpet. A little of the official atmosphere seemed to have fallen away from him with the new speak words, but his expression was grimmer than usual, as though he were not pleased at being disturbed. The terror that Winston already felt was suddenly shot through by a streak of ordinary embarrassment. It seemed to him quite possible that he had simply made a stupid mistake. For what evidence had he in reality that O'Brien was any kind of political conspirator? Nothing but a flash of the eyes and a single equivocal remark. Beyond that, only his own secret imaginings founded on a dream. He could not even fall back on the pretense that he had come to borrow the dictionary, because in that case, Julia's presence was impossible to explain. As O'Brien passed the telescreen, a thought seemed to strike him. He stopped, turned aside, and pressed a switch on the wall. There was a sharp snap. The voice had stopped. Julia uttered a tiny sound, a sort of squeak of surprise. Even in the midst of his panic, Winston was too much taken aback to be able to hold his tongue. "You can turn it off," he said. "Yes," said O'Brien, "we can turn it off. We have that privilege." He was up, yes?
I'm just noticing, like, now you think about the fact that had you not brought Julia along, you could have still had an excuse of the dictionary. You absolute twerp.
He really wasn't thinking, was he?
Nope. Then again, the author might have just wanted to speed up their deaths. So.
I've been writing about these idiots too much. I
need to kill them off. I need to do a J.R.R. J.R.R.? Yes.
George R.R.
Thank you. Close enough. George R.R., J.R.R. You know, they both killed the characters a lot. Tolkien.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember how many died in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, God. So many.
We read it last year.
So many deaths.
Look at the Battle
of the Ents, man. Look at the Ents.
Yeah, but those were all like nameless orcs and Ents.
How dare you? How dare you not think of the Ents? The poor Ents. Yeah. He made Ents meat. You're welcome.
Okay, he was opposite them now. His solid form towered over the pair of them, and the expression on his face was still indecipherable. He was waiting, somewhat sternly, for Winston to speak. But about what? Even now it was quite conceivable that he was simply a busy man wondering irritably why he had been interrupted. Nobody spoke. After the stopping of the telescreen, the room seemed deadly silent. The seconds marched past, enormous. With difficulty, Winston continued to keep his eyes fixed on O'Brien's. Then suddenly the grim face broke down into what might have been the beginnings of a smile. With his characteristic gesture, O'Brien resettled his spectacles on his nose. "Shall I say it, or will you?" he said. "I will say it," said Winston promptly. "That thing is really turned off?" "Yes, everything is turned off. We are alone. We have come here because—" He paused, realizing for the first time the vagueness of his own motives. Since he did not in fact know what kind of help he expected from O'Brien, it was not easy to say why he had come here. He went on, conscious that what he was saying must sound both feeble and pretentious. "We believe that there is some kind of conspiracy, some kind of secret organization working against the party, and that you are involved in it. We want to join it and work for it. We are enemies of the party. We disbelieve in the principles of Ingsoc. We are thought criminals. We are also adulterers. I tell you this because we want to put ourselves at your mercy. If you want us to incriminate ourselves in any other way, we are ready." He stopped and glanced over his shoulder with the feeling that the door had opened. Sure enough, the little yellow-faced servant had come in without knocking. Winston saw that he was carrying a tray with a decanter and glasses. "Martin is one of us," said O'Brien impassively. "Bring the drinks over here, Martin. Put them on the round table. Have we enough chairs? Then we may as well sit down and talk in comfort. Bring a chair for yourself, Martin. This is business. You can stop being a servant for the next 10 minutes. The little man sat down quite at his ease, and yet still with a servant-like air, the air of a valet enjoying a privilege. Winston regarded him out of the corner of his eye. It struck him that the man's whole life was playing a part, and that he felt it to be dangerous to drop his assumed personality even for a moment. O'Brien took the decanter by the neck and filled up the glasses with a dark red liquid. It aroused in Winston dim memories of something seen long ago on a wall or a hoarding. A vast bottle composed of electric lights, which seemed to move up and down and pour its contents into a glass. Seen from the top, the stuff looked almost black, but in the decanter it gleamed like a ruby. It had a sour sweet smell. He saw Julia pick up her glass and sniff at it with frank curiosity. "It is called wine," said O'Brien with a faint smile. "You will have read about it in books, no doubt. Not much of it gets to the outer party, I am afraid." His face grew solemn again, and he raised his glass. "I think it is fitting that we should begin by drinking a health. To our leader, to Emmanuel Goldstein." Winston took up his glass with a certain eagerness. Wine was a thing he had read and dreamed about. Like the glass paperweight or Mr. Charrington's half-remembered rhymes, it belonged to the vanished romantic past, the olden time, as he liked to call it in his secret thoughts. For some reason, he had always thought of wine as having an intensely sweet taste, like that of blackberry jam, and an immediate intoxicating effect. Actually, when he came to swallow it, the stuff was distinctly disappointing. The truth was that after years of gin drinking, he could barely taste it. He set down the empty glass. "Then there is such a person as Goldstein?" he said. "Yes, there is such a person, and he is alive. Where? I do not know. And the conspiracy, the organization, is it real? It is not simply an invention of the dot police? No, it is real. The Brotherhood, we call it. You will never learn much more about the Brotherhood than that it exists and that you belong to it. I will come back to that presently." He looked at his wristwatch. It is unwise even for members of the inner party to turn off the telescreen for more than half an hour. You ought not to have come here together, and you will have to leave separately. You, comrade, he bowed his head to Julia, will leave first. We have about 20 minutes at our disposal. You will understand that I must start by asking you certain questions. In general terms, what are you prepared to do? Anything that we are capable of, said Winston. O'Brien had turned himself a little in his chair so that he was facing Winston. He almost ignored Julia, seeming to take it for granted that Winston could speak for her. For a moment the lids flitted down over his eyes. He began asking his questions in a low, expressionless voice, as though this were a routine, a sort of catechism, most of whose answers were known to him already. You are prepared to give your lives? Yes. You are prepared to commit murder? Yes. To commit acts of sabotage which may cause the death of hundreds of innocent people? Yes. To betray your country to foreign powers? Yes. You are prepared to cheat, to forge, to blackmail, to corrupt the minds of children, to distribute habit-forming drugs, to encourage prostitution, to disseminate venereal diseases, to do anything which is likely to cause demoralization and weaken the power of the party? Yes. If, for example, it would somehow serve our interests to throw sulfuric acid in a child's face, are you prepared to do that? Yes. You are prepared to lose your identity and live out the rest of your life as a waiter or a dock worker? Yes. You are prepared to commit suicide, if and when we order you to do so? Yes. You are prepared, the two of you, to separate and never see one another again? No, broke in Julia. It appeared to Winston that a long time passed before he answered. For a moment he seemed even to have been deprived of the power of speech. His tongue worked soundlessly, forming the opening syllables first of one word, then of the other, over and over again. Until he had said it, he did not know which word he was going to say. No, he said finally. You did well to tell me, said O'Brien. It is necessary for us to know everything. He turned himself toward Julia and added in a voice with somewhat more expression in it, Do you understand that even if he survives, it may be as a different person? We may be obliged to give him a new identity. His face, his movements, the shape of his hands, the color of his hair, even his voice would be different. And you yourself might have become a different person. Our surgeons can alter people beyond recognition. Sometimes it is necessary. Sometimes we even amputate a limb. Winston could not help snatching another sidelong glance at Martin's Mongolian face. There were no scars that he could see. Julia had turned a shade paler so that her freckles were showing, but she faced O'Brien boldly. She murmured something that seemed to be assent. Good, then that is settled. There was a silver box of cigarettes on the table. With a rather absent-minded air, O'Brien pushed them towards the others, took one himself, then stood up and began to pace slowly to and fro, as though he could think better standing. They were very good cigarettes, very thick and well-packed, with an unfamiliar silkiness in the paper. O'Brien looked at his wristwatch again. You had better go back to your pantry, Martin, he said. I shall switch on in a quarter of an hour. Take a good look at these comrades' faces before you go. You will be seeing them again. I may not. Exactly as they had done at the front door, the little man's dark eyes flickered over their faces. There was not a trace of friendliness in his manner. He was memorizing their appearance, but he felt no interest in them or appeared to feel none. It occurred to Winston that his synthetic face was perhaps incapable of changing its expression. Without speaking or giving any kind of salutation, Martin went out, closing the door silently behind him. O'Brien was strolling up and down, one hand in the pocket of his black overalls, the other holding his cigarette. You understand, he said, that you will be fighting in the dark. You will always be in the dark. You will receive orders, and you will obey them, without knowing why. Later, I shall send you a book from which you will learn the true nature of the society we live in, and the strategy by which we shall destroy it. When you have read the book, you will be full members of the Brotherhood. Yes?
So you'll be receiving orders and obey them without knowing why. How's that any different to the party?
The party actually tells you why, in service of Big Brother.
That's not a reason. Well, yeah, they've hammered it so much in them that that's the only reason why they should be doing it. It's for the good of the party.
Yeah.
So in this case is, you will do it because it's not for the good of the party.
It is kind of trading one master for another, and this one is a little more without sure footing because the party does have an answer for everything. It is a stupid answer, but it's an answer. Mm. Like, you know, all the things he asked. Are you prepared to, throw a child on an acid's face? Sorry, throw a child on an acid's face. Yes, throw acid on a child's face.
Yes.
And other horrific things.
Yeah, it's not any different to the party, really.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm.
But between the general aims that we are fighting for and the immediate tasks of the moment, you will never know anything. I tell you that the Brotherhood exists, but I cannot tell you whether it numbers 100 members or 10 million. From your personal knowledge, you will never be able to say that it numbers even as many as a dozen. You will have 3 or 4 contacts who will be renewed from time to time as they disappear. As this was your first contact, it will be preserved. When you receive orders, they will come from me. If we find it necessary to communicate with you, it will be through Martin. When you are finally caught, you will confess. That is unavoidable. But you will have very little to confess other than your own actions. You will not be able to betray more than a handful of unimportant people. Probably you will not even betray me. By that time, I may be dead, or I shall have become a different person with a different face. He continued to move to and fro over the soft carpet. In spite of the bulkiness of his body, there was a remarkable grace in his movements. It came out even in the gesture with which he thrust a hand into his pocket or manipulated a cigarette. More even than of strength, he gave an impression of confidence and of an understanding tinged by irony. However much in earnest he might be, he had nothing of the single-mindedness that belongs to a fanatic. When he spoke of murder, suicide, venereal disease, amputated limbs, and altered faces, it was with a faint air of persiflage. "This is unavoidable," his voice seemed to say. "This is what we have got to do unflinchingly. But this is not what we shall be doing when life is worth living again." A wave of admiration, almost of worship, flowed out from Winston towards O'Brien. For the moment he had forgotten the shadowy figure of Goldstein. When he looked at O'Brien's powerful shoulders and his blunt-featured face, so ugly and yet so civilized, it was impossible to believe that he could be defeated. There was no stratagem that he was not equal to, no danger that he could not foresee. Even Julia seemed to be impressed. She had let her cigarette go out and was listening intently. O'Brien went on. "You will have heard rumors of the existence of the Brotherhood. No doubt you have formed your own picture of it. You have imagined, probably, a huge underworld of conspirators meeting secretly in cellars, scribbling messages on walls, recognizing one another by code words or by special movements of the hand. Nothing of the kind exists. The members of the Brotherhood have no way of recognizing one another, and it is impossible for any one member to be aware of the identity of more than a few others. Goldstein himself, if he fell into the hands of the Thought Police, could not give them a complete list of members, or any information that would lead them to a complete list. No such list exists. The Brotherhood cannot be wiped out because it is not an organization in the ordinary sense. Nothing holds it together except an idea which is indestructible. You will never have anything to sustain you except the idea. You will get no comradeship and no encouragement. When finally you are caught, you will get no help. We never help our members. At most, when it is absolutely necessary that someone should be silenced, we are occasionally able to smuggle a razor blade into a prisoner's cell. You will have to get used to living without results and without hope. You will work for a while. Yes?
As opposed to their current existence, where they live without results and without hope.
Well, I guess they have results.
What results?
Work?
They keep undoing existence of previous work. That is...
I mean, it's to fill their time, but they feel like they're doing something, I guess.
You will work for a while.
You will work for a while. You will be caught, you will confess, and then you will die. Those are the only results that you will ever see. There is no possibility that any perceptible change will happen within our own lifetime. We are the dead. Our only true life is in the future. We shall take part in it as handfuls of dust and splinters of bone. But how far away that future may be, there is no knowing. It might be 1,000 years. At present, nothing is possible except to extend the area of sanity little by little. We cannot act collectively. We can only spread our knowledge outwards from individual to individual, generation after generation. In the face of the Thought Police, there is no other way. He halted and looked for the third time at his wristwatch. "It is almost time for you to leave, comrade," he said to Julia. "Wait, the decanter is still half full." He filled the glasses and raised his own glass by the stem. "What shall it be this time?" he said, still with the same faint suggestion of irony. "To the confusion of the thought police? To the death of Big Brother? To humanity? To the future?" "To the past," said Winston. "The past is more important," agreed O'Brien gravely. They emptied their glasses, and a moment later Julia stood up to go. O'Brien took a small box from the top of a cabinet and handed her a flat white tablet, which he told her to place on her tongue. It was important, he said, not to go out smelling of wine. The lift attendants were very observant. As soon as the door had shut behind her, he appeared to forget her existence. He took another pace or two up and down, then stopped. "There are details to be settled," he said. "I assume that you have a hiding place of some kind?" Winston explained about the room over Mr. Charrington's shop. "That will do for the moment. Later we will..." "Yes?"
I love how he's just gone hook, line, sinker, believing this guy.
Yeah. Because he wants so strongly to believe.
He wants so strongly to... Yeah, so strongly. And so he's like, "Here's our hiding place," which they probably already know about. But yeah, you know.
Well, yes, if O'Brien is a member of the Thought Police, I assume they already know everything about Winston and Juliet, given how they've built up the Thought Police. Even O'Brien has built up the Thought Police in this conversation.
Yeah, multiple times now.
"That will do for the moment. Later we will arrange something else for you. It is important to change one's hiding place frequently. Meanwhile, I shall send you a copy of the book." Sorry, that's all in capitals. I thought I should read it like that.
That's not capitals. It's italicized. Weird.
"The book."
No.
That's the last time I do it, I promise.
Thank you.
Even O'Brien, Winston noticed, seemed to pronounce the words as though they were in italics.
See, they're meant to be in italics. Someone edited mine, went, "Why is it capitalized and not in italics?" Then they fixed that.
So should I read the book?
Yes.
Goldstein's book, you understand, as soon as possible. It may be some days before I can get hold of one. There are not many in existence, as you can imagine. The police hunt them down and destroy them almost as fast as we can produce them. It makes very little difference. The book is indestructible. If the last copy were gone, we could reproduce it almost word for word. Do you carry a briefcase to work with you? He added. As a rule, yes. What is it like? Black, very shabby, with two straps. Black, two straps, very shabby. Good. One day, in the fairly near future, I cannot give you a date, one of the messages among your morning's work will contain a misprinted word, and you will have to ask for a repeat. On the following day, you will go to work without your briefcase. At some time during the day, in the street, a man will touch you on the arm and say, 'I think you have dropped your briefcase.' The one he gives you will contain a copy of Goldstein's book. You will return it within 14 days. They were silent for a moment. "There are a couple of minutes before you need go," said O'Brien. "We shall meet again, if we do meet again." Winston looked up at him. "In the place where there is no darkness?" he said hesitantly. O'Brien nodded without appearance of surprise. "In the place where there is no darkness," he said, as though he had recognized the allusion. "And in the meantime, is there anything that you wish to say before you leave? Any message? Any question?" Winston thought. There did not seem to be any further question that he wanted to ask. Still less did he feel any impulse to utter high-sounding generalities. Instead of anything directly connected with O'Brien or the Brotherhood, there came into his mind a sort of composite picture of the dark bedroom where his mother had spent her last days, and the little room over Mr. Charrington's shop, and the glass paperweight, and the steel engraving in its rosewood frame. Almost at random, he said, "Did you ever happen to hear an old rhyme that begins, 'Oranges and lemons say the bells of St. Clement's?'" Again O'Brien nodded. With a sort of grave courtesy, he completed the stanza. "Oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clement's. You owe me 3 farthings, say the bells of St. Martin's. When will you pay me, say the bells of Old Bailey? When I grow rich, say the bells of Shoreditch." "You know the last line," said Winston. "Yes, I know the last line. And now I am afraid it is time for you to go. But wait, you had better let me give you one of those tablets." As Winston stood up, O'Brien held out a hand. His powerful grip crushed the bones of Winston's palm. At the door, Winston looked back, but O'Brien seemed already to be in process of putting him out of mind. He was waiting with his hand on the switch that controlled the telescreen. Beyond him, Winston could see the writing table with its green shaded lamp and the speakwrite and the wire baskets deep laden with papers. The incident was closed. Within 30 seconds, it occurred to him O'Brien would be back at his interrupted and important work on behalf of the party.
That's just weird.
And that is that chapter. Thoughts? Rue is thinking.
So, I don't trust him, and it's just simple as that. I just know, like, the way he's kind of... I think the author also kind of points it out with this constant air of irony, and like, there's something about him. Like, the way he's kind of reciting this, citing stuff, like, not casually, but, like, in this rote way of, would you kill people, blah, 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 blah. Like, that's not...
You'd think he'd be a little more serious.
Yeah, there's a certain flippancy. Not flippancy. Wrong word.
What was it? Parsifuge?
Yes. That actually... Just that odd... almost like he's just saying a script that he's like, okay, here's another one.
That maybe he's had this conversation hundreds of times before.
Yeah.
And not as a member of the resistance, but as a member of the party trapping the resistance.
Yes. That's the thing. Like, he's giving me the impression of a fisherman that's got like, yeah, okay, let's go. Oh, let's cast a line. Oh, look, we got a bite. Yeah, it's like, it's the same kind of like...
On that line of thinking, the responses that Winston gives, you know, saying we'll meet in the place where there is no darkness, or asking him about the end of the rhyme, like his response to those questions seems to have an air of almost, so you're one of these.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you're a person who is curious. Well, the fact that he's curious about the past.
He toasted to the past.
Well, he said yes, and the past is very important kind of thing. You're like, he, I think, realizes, this is a person that is still too steeped in the past. So, I mean, the party wants to just separate people from their history because it's in their advantage.
Yes.
If you have a population that has no ground, no... It's just floating, is suspending in water.
No anchor, yeah.
No anchor, that's the word. So I'm just looking at this going, yes, the past is very important because, in my mind, I'm continuing that sentence before O'Brien saying, because it's the one thing that we need to get rid of in order to control our population fully. No. Like, I think those two things kind of made him go, oh, yeah, like you're saying, you're that kind of person. Okay, I know how to respond to you. I know how to...
Well, Winston is also a dreamer, I think, as well. It's just there. He thinks that he might have an effect on the future.
Yeah. Well, more that he will be part of the past that is still seen in the future. That sounds strange, but yeah.
He
will endure.
Yeah, he wants what really any one of us really want, and... I mean, biologically, it's why we have children, but we all want to leave our mark on the world. We want to be remembered in some capacity.
Yeah, it's not necessarily we want to be remembered, but we want to know that we've had an impact. And if you haven't had an impact, you feel like you've... I don't know, it's pretty... The whole thing, he just comes across as insincere. I'm just thinking it because of the reason he comes across mainly as insincere is, yes, the way the author is describing him. His reaction to less expected questions.
Let's go at this from another angle. Let's say you're right.
Also Martin. The other thing. The fact that Winston noticed that Martin wouldn't put down his servant's mask, if that makes sense. Like, mm-hmm. He's saying, even when he's having a 10-minute reprieve, it feels like he is playing a role, and he can't not play the role because it would be dangerous for him. If O'Brien's sincere, then if he's telling his servant, no, you can chill for a bit, he would have taken off that mask. But he didn't. He's like, nope, I need to witness this stuff because this is my job.
Right. And something I want to bring up, because it was mentioned that he's either Chinese or Mongolian. They used both words describing him.
Yeah.
The only other time we've seen anyone else of a different ethnicity was the Mongolian prisoners in that.
Yeah, they're part of Eurasia.
Yeah. So it's interesting that the inner party, he has a servant of another ethnicity.
Yeah, they go out, they get their resources, they get their slaves, and they won't get people from their own population to do this stuff because the own population intermingles with their own population. And so ideas will spread.
Right.
They'll observe stuff and it will spread. That actually explains to us, remember how they were discussing how did she get her hands on inner party stuff?
Mm.
They would be very, and how it's difficult to get your hands on inner
party stuff. But everyone does.
Not everyone does.
No, she said you work there, you always steal. That's
well,
the thing.
Well, she works in a department that's a little bit, was she in the novel? Was she?
She's in the fiction department.
She's in the fiction department, and part of what they do is also create pornography and stuff for the pros. It would be understandable that within the fiction department, they need to actually have a grasp on certain things so that they can, because the proles will remember a lot of stuff.
Okay.
The proles haven't actively had their you know, information.
No, they're just, they have to work in manual labor. They're obsessed with the lottery and kept in distracted with pornography and alcohol, and they have bombs dropped on them. So they're basically, as we said before, they're
cannon fodder.
They're surviving, so they don't have any time to really focus on anything else. It doesn't mean they're stupid, not by any stretch of the imagination.
No. And it doesn't mean that they don't have recollections, because this is a population that has intergeneration. So they have information that's been passed down, information-wise, from generation to generation. So the fiction department would have access to more of those things, tools, that kind of information, so that they can help manipulate.
Yeah, I imagine so.
The process, because they need to make it relevant to what they talk about and what their memories are.
Yeah. So I wanted to kind of go at that chapter from the other side. So let's say you're right, and O'Brien is a member of either, you know, maybe he's a member of the Thought Police. Hmm. So this chapter then would be written not only to get Winston to put his guard down, but as a reader who doesn't yet know what's going to happen.
Well, unless the reader picks it up.
I think it's meant to convince the reader as well that, Winston's now found an in. He was right about O'Brien.
Yeah, it's relief. It's meant to provide that the pre-crisis relief, so to speak, because they've been accumulating. They're like, crisis? Is the crisis going to come? No, it's not a crisis.
Well, even I think it's now been since the start of the book, I said there's a huge thing that happens, you know, around the halfway point. We're past the halfway point yet. That thing hasn't happened. I mentioned a couple of chapters ago, this is when Hate Week starts. That hasn't happened yet. So my recollection of when events take place within the scope of this novel has been way off.
Well, he's like, there's something about it that's, even that moment, that sense of where he starts to panic.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, wait.
I've been an idiot.
I brought Julius, so there's no way of excusing this. And I don't know how to, this is actually a situation, what if I'm wrong? He has just that one moment of clarity.
Yeah.
It's almost just where you see your life flashing before your eyes. Just that one instant of clarity.
And that's not metaphor, because at that point he couldn't have done anything. He would have been even more suspicious and full of folly.
And now, if we listen to what's going on about the Brotherhood, they're like, well, will you commit suicide if you tell you to? It's the same kind of loyalty and obligations that they are asking of in the party. It's no different. The only difference is, one is for Big Brother, one is for Goldstein.
Mm. But, well, now, the end goal of the resistance is to one day destroy the party.
Well, was the party's purpose? The party's purpose is to destroy the Brotherhood.
Actually, I think the party's purpose is just to continue to survive.
Take
over the world, or even just to endure.
Well, they want the party's rule. The party's purpose is Okay, these wars, they're just there as a distraction, they're just there as a show, and we're going to tell, but we're going to tell the people that we're fighting a war, and then we're successful, and then we fight another war, and then we're successful, but we're fighting another war, and then we're...
But remember, we've also said before that the Brotherhood is probably an invention of them as well.
Yeah.
To have an enemy that they could keep pointing to.
Exactly. It makes sense. Like, they always want to be in...
So if that's the case, their goal isn't to destroy something they've created.
No. So but in reality, the way that they convey to the population, Brotherhood says our goals are to destroy the party, and the party will say, "Oh, our goal is to destroy the Brotherhood and anything that is against the party." It's the same narrative, just
two sides of the same coin, as it were.
Tomato, really. It's at the end of the day, it's still a red fruit that you put in salads.
But the resistance is noble, Rue. They're fighting for a good cause.
Yes, I can see how throwing sulfuric acid on a child would be noble.
Yeah, out of all the horrific examples he could drum up to, like,
How casual he was about it. It's just the same as when, okay, going back to the right at the beginning of the book, where he's watching that thing in the cinema, the refugee, the mother trying to protect her child.
As the plane shoots her full of holes, yeah.
Yeah, so and the complete disregard and disconnect between the value of human life and affection and family and all these things, neither of them are for it. He's like, you're going to be on your own, and will you be willing to separate? No. Okay, well, if you're not going to be willing to separate, you're going to have to deal with the fact that we're going to completely remake you. Like, it's...
Oh, there's something I did want to bring up on your idea of the Brotherhood just being the party with a different shade of paint on it.
Is
that those questions asked of him? I mean, on one hand, I can understand them because they are a resistance movement, and often, you know, resistance movements justified the need for violence in order to reach their aims. I don't know if I agree with it, but that's a reality.
Yeah,
that's a reality, but. Especially the extent he was going, my thought is like, but if you, it's one of those, it's almost that the intention of your actions rather than the end. If you defeat Big Brother through these tactics,
you're just replacing it.
Yes.
God bless the king. Or the king is dead, long live the king.
Yeah.
It's the same difference. I just had a realization. I wonder if he switched off the telescreen or if he switched it to record.
Ah.
Because essentially that would be a confession.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because they straight up said, we're enemies of the party, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. It was actually really... when Winston first spoke and said what he was there for, it was very matter of fact, wasn't it?
Well,
we're thought criminals. We want to destroy the Big Brother, the party. We hate Big Brother.
Yeah, I think the way that he said it was literally, I don't know how to say this. I'm just going to straight up blah. Because, hey, well, we're not being recorded, apparently. And he seems to, and either way, if I don't say it, he's going to say it. That's what he says. But the reality is, he wouldn't have necessarily said it. We don't know if he would have said anything. True. You're here for the dictionary, right?
Well, we couldn't have said that because of Julia.
Well, he could have still said it. So why he could have gone, so you're here for the dictionary, and you brought Julia because she's in fiction, she might be interested in this as well.
Okay, so I have a question, and it has a different answer whether or not you believe O'Brien's on the level, but... What do you think of I'm not going to ask about the fact that he can turn it off, because that seems to be one of those privileges that
we have that privilege.
But how about how he said, it may be honest or not, but I'm tending to think it is honest. He goes, it's not a good idea to leave it off for more than half an hour.
Yeah. Unless it's not off, but just recorded. And he's got a limit.
That's true, but... But to me, it was that idea of, you know, the inner party are we made allusion. Now, they pretty much are the 1%. They have so many perks, and they're basically running the party. But yet, that idea that still, even for us, we at least have to keep the illusion that everything's going right.
Yeah. That would work. But yeah, something about this is just...
Well, because it seems so weird to me, the idea that if they have a privilege that they can turn it off, and, you know, if they basically are the 1% and they're behind everything, they're running the party.
Yeah, this whole thing is...
Why is there a fear of leaving it off?
Well, because then they couldn't trust...
Oh, maybe there is that distrust of man, the 1% as well.
Look what they're willing to do to the rest of the population. What are they going to do to each other?
Yeah, okay.
Rats on a sinking ship, man.
right.
Rats eat rats.
So it's, we have this privilege, but we don't know who might be watching, and we don't want to give ammunition to anyone else we may be having issues
with. To be blunt, you know the expression dog eat dog world?
Yeah.
This is what that world looks like. So we need to maybe stop working, just in real life, maybe start working away from 1984 as a template, because that is literally what happens when you have it. Well, we can use rat eat rat world, given the fact they have so many rats and they eat kids' faces off.
Well, we have that in parts of the world. New York's got a crazy rat problem.
Yes, they do. But they're not hungry, at least not for humans.
Well, I mean, there's so much wonderful trash in that city.
Exactly, they want food. But the point is, yeah, that. Let's be very aware of that. Anyway, so, getting under. So, yeah, this O'Brien is making me... By the way, I have a problem with the name O'Brien, and this is all the fault of a jingle.
Yeah, we have a window,
a glass repair.
Service here that's called O'Brien windshield repair, isn't it?
And just because this is not to give them any promotion, but they're going to get it anyway. So they've got this jingle, and it kind of goes, "Oh, oh, oh, O'Brien," and you're like,
yeah.
Every time I see that name in this book, I'm like,
"Yep, yep."
Is it here to fix the fish tank? I don't know.
See, that's what he was doing on the speak right before. It's like, oh, no.
He was discussing the production cost, yes.
The new machinery for replacing windshields, it's not cost effective.
It's not enough profit margin. Yeah, the whole thing. That's the other thing. Like, he's casually discussing crime think. And he's, I think he's using
I actually really appreciate that you stopped me and you took the time to decipher that, because I thought that was... interesting in itself. I was just going to breeze over it because I'm like, it's newspeak. I don't care. But
it's not only newspeak. I think it's the new edition newspeak.
Ah.
Because he was...
That's double plus on good.
That. Because that didn't exist. And Symes brought it up as existing in the new edition. So I would say even the new edition... new edition newspeak, I suspect, is being used by the inner party members. Very, very narrow down in a very small band, so that it's really restricted, and then it's going to be implemented more further, but it's very much in a party.
Or do you think they'll always have their own version of it so that they can't easily be understood by the lower classes?
Well, no, the lower classes are being indoctrinated by newspeak. Therefore, they can maintain their usual language, but it's obsolete. But in a few generations, if they're not taught the previous language, if they're only taught newspeak.
You know, I'm just thinking now, it may seem obvious, but that's another way that I think they are really distancing children from their parents, is that the language keeps devolving.
Yeah, they're introducing further language barriers, because, I mean, treat it as a new language that is highly restricted and that is reducing the ability to express anything that is not strictly party business. That's it. Like, it's the ability to express thought. Symes said it. Like, this is about destroying language, which in turn is the destruction of communication between and everything. It destroys. It's interesting that of course this is the perspective of an author or a writer writing this, which makes sense. That for him, he's going to focus on language as being fundamental. to, like, it is fundamental to civilization.
Well, I think though that I can't remember if it was Winston or Syme that said it, but the idea that I think it's very apt in that if you do not have the necessary words, you cannot create certain thoughts.
Yeah, no, and that's I think what he's this is possibly what Orwell is, one of the themes he's exploring is this very concept that when we deny a population access to the ability to express themselves or to even define things, because that thing is not a non-existent anymore, you've already erased its existence, you've gotten rid of books so they can't really read about it.
It is one of the things where, as much as I love Twitter, I always in the back of my mind it's been that idea of you're really limiting our ability to communicate with this character limit.
That's why I've ended up with Twitter posts with, like, what was the last one? 12
sections. Yeah, threading.
I'm like,
but okay. Even that, you know, it's
not, yeah, it's not great. But I mean, Twitter isn't that platform. But at the same, it's not a platform. It's a platform where you can link to, say, an article that you write.
True.
This is more. That's more a Telegram. That is literally what they are. Twitter is a Telegram system.
Yeah.
It's a bit faster and it's a little bit more interactive, but it is still a Telegram.
It's not a good place to have a discussion, even in DMs where there is no character limit.
Yeah, it's not. Well, text only has always been a bit of a issue.
That's what emojis are for. We can get her for
emojis help. They do. They're like
because
the modern day hieroglyphic.
Well, you can. It's not perfect, but you can try and convey the emotion behind the text you're writing at the end of every sentence.
Like, this is the tone. This is the tone I'm conveying. But yeah, it's interesting that this is coming from a writer.
Mm.
That a writer is specifically highlighting how that a lack of ability to communicate will erode the very foundations of a society and their ability to actually think for themselves even.
You know what this does remind me of? And maybe this is me being silly, but have you ever looked at, you know, the correspondence of learned people from even 100 or 200 years ago, and how the letters they write each other are just so much more eloquent and full of amazing vocabulary and just the poetry of the writing than anything you read today?
There are good things and bad things about being eloquent. Actually, eloquence does not mean verbose. I think that's the one thing that's different. I don't agree with Newspeak. This is not pro-Newspeak talk. Newspeak is horrendous to me as a concept.
Words, as it should be to anyone.
Yes. Language and words are beautiful. Some people can wield it artistically, like in terms of like they know how to convey things so beautifully. And that's, you know, writers are a great example of that. A good writer, a good author. Correspondence, people who are really good at correspondence. Words make a difference in how things are understood. The fact that we use emojis to try and convey the tone, I would say it's a shortfall, and it's usually a sign of we're back to this concept of we're in such a rush to express things, which is kind of funny considering the life expectancy has increased. Life expectancy has increased, but our sense of urgency and rush is robbing us of our
actually
expression.
You just kind of answered it for me, because when you had a letter to send to someone that might take weeks to get there and you might not get a response for a month or two, you might want to make this something special. Whereas, you know, ever since increased postal service, or especially since the creation of email, well, if I can just send something to you instantly and you can send me back, why should I take the time to craft this lovingly created
something that is actually
piece of prose?
You'd hope for comprehensive communication, and the problem is that we have devalued the emotional impact of communication, because you're working in a job, in any company or whatever. Say you get a business letter. They are not concerned, and this is not all workplaces are like this, but in general, in a corporate structure, it's not about your feelings. Your feelings are irrelevant. In a corporate structure, you are stripped of who you are, or what makes you essentially human, because that's not the priority or the goals of a corporation. I mean, we're looking at the party. It's the same function. It's the same purpose.
How can you enrich the corporation?
Your entire function when you attend a meeting is what benefit you are bringing to the corporation. So they're not, the communication is not going to be loaded with emotion evoking or so evocative language won't be a priority. Even expressing things in a way so that's it. There's removing the evocation of feelings. The feelings don't come into our communication at all in a business level. And I'm not saying everyone needs to write fluffy floral letters in a business setting. I'm just saying because we've deprioritized it, we're losing a skill set. Making our workplaces less sustainable for individuals to last through, and it also and essentially we're inducing a form of don't quote me on this it's inducing a society that promotes a sociopathic attitude. Psychopathy is usually genetic inheritance or trauma induced, sort of, but it's usually different. Sociopathy is not genetic. Sociopathy is environment induced. We are told constantly to strip ourselves of emotion, that emotion is irrelevant. You can be detached from your emotional reactions. Like you can kind of go, okay, look, before I react, let me think about it. Let me reflect on it. Let me not. But you know, old teachers used to count to 100 before they went for the birch stick.
Also used to teach grammar.
Yes, they also used to teach grammar. But the idea is that you're meant to pause, reflect, and then decide how to channel those feelings instead of just completely cutting them off and amputating yourself emotionally.
Well, I think, and I'm not Buddhist myself, so I'm probably not the best person to speak on it, but that's a mistake I think a lot of people make about Buddhism, that idea of being in the moment or being at peace. I think there's a misunderstanding of, you know, you're detaching yourself from your emotions, when the truth is that no. If something makes you angry, you fully acknowledge that anger and you accept it, and you, because you've taken the time to do that and you're not repressing it all, the anger will pass through you much quicker, and then you can return to a state of serenity.
Going back to the pain example we mentioned earlier, you can be in pain. You can acknowledge the pain. I have no problem with pain acceptance personally, and I'm a person who deals with a lot of sources of pain, really long.
Including when I come over.
No. But yeah, the idea of I accept that it's there. And if I'm having a new form of pain, I accept it. I recognize it. That's okay. And I don't, it's not, doesn't mean that you're dwelling. Accepting and recognizing and identifying is not the same as dwelling. Sometimes you can't avoid it when it's completely overwhelming and it's completely distracting when it's at that point, and that's probably a good indicator that you need to get it looked at. But you need to, if you don't accept that you're in pain and you go into this denial or suppression, it will come back and it will kick your ass.
Well, that's the same thing. Everyone's probably had that experience where something makes you angry, and then for however long it takes, you get trapped up in reliving the memory over and over, and you keep getting angrier and angrier, and you stew. Depression actually works a lot that way. You're sad about something, and you keep revisiting the fact that you're sad, and it kind of keeps spiraling in on itself, and you get worse and worse.
You can end up numb, and that's bad, because humans are meant to feel emotions. If you do not feel emotions, you should probably seek counseling. We feel emotions. How we express them will differ from one end of the universe to the other. There's no limit on how it can be expressed. What is socially acceptable with how we express it, that's another thing. And what is socially constructive, again, another thing. But in terms of dear humans, you are allowed to feel. That is literally, it's part of what you are. You don't need to not feel. That is, in a corporate setting, you're discouraged. You're actively discouraged from allowing your feelings to influence the workplace, right? But if your workplace is being oppressive and discouraging, it's going to affect, say, a creative workspace. It's going to mess up the products. It's going to mess up productivity. Everything is affected by the emotional state of your workers. Yeah. It doesn't mean everything needs to be a fluffy and non-competitive or non-challenging environment. Challenging is fine. Challenge, be challenged by what you're trying, by your goals and what you're trying to achieve. But you don't need to compromise your existence as a human being to rise up to the challenge.
To survive.
Yeah, if you're having to chop out your emotional state just to exist, what are you existing for?
Well, and this gets into a whole nother conversation, so I'll just leave it with the idea.
Yeah.
And sadly, I think that's why so many turn to alcohol and other.
Well, yeah, substance abuse is a obvious tool of coping, which we see in society. It's substance abuse and other stuff. Like, why? It's self-medicating. People are self-medicating to cope with the fact that they're being hammered, and we're trying to use humans as a commodity. So I mean, we looked at it here with Winston. He drinks so much gin, it was badly affecting his health. He stopped or reduced significantly
because of love,
because he had a way to emotionally connect and feel. He was allowed to feel. And it made a massive, it had a massive impact on his pattern, because he no longer wanted to escape reality. I mean, he knew reality wasn't going to be great, but he was facing it.
He had something worth living for.
Yes. Why? Yeah. If you're at the point where you are disrupting your emotional health, and that is literally cutting out a part of yourself, what are you living for? Of course people are going to turn to substances and behaviors that are maybe less than
legal. Okay.
Well, I was about to say more risky, high risk behavior.
Ah, yes, yes. So next episode is the longest chapter in the book. And I think this might be the chapter when stuff goes down. But don't quote me on that, because I've been wrong multiple times now. But I am very much looking forward to that.
We'll drink a lot of water and we'll record the whole thing. And then
maybe decide to break it up.
Dave can decide what to do in editing.
Well, if I decide to break it up, we'll record another intro and outro. But I think, hey,
we can just record multiple.
It's a podcast. If you want to stop listening and come back later, your app or your web browser has that ability.
Usually, yes, yes.
Okay. So you can find us on Twitter. I'm at Dave_the_turnip.
And I'm Rue McMoo, as well as you can find our Twitter at SMBSLT podcast. I always forget.
Same thing with our Facebook page.
Yep. And
the music at the top of the episode was Ministry of Love by the Eurythmics. The music at the end will, as always, be I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. So until next time, read as many books as you can.
Well, read as many books as you'd like to.
As you can. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.